Hello, everyone, and welcome to Teach Me Teacher, a podcast for educators where we, the teachers, become students ourselves. I'm your host, Jacob Chastain. Tomorrow is the first day of school for me. I am super pumped, and I am here for part two with Barbara Oakley talking about her book, Learning How to Learn. I love this episode because we're diving into the science of learning, which is great for teachers. It's great for students to know as well. I think we overlook these pieces of information far too often in favor of structures and strategies, which are amazing, but we also need to learn why we do those structures and strategies and why they work. This is a perfect episode. Stick around for the end for a book giveaway.
Good morning, class!
So cool to be yourself in life and in your class.
Kids just want to be loved and they want to be noticed for who they are.
Students respond a lot better to kind, positive remarks.
The thing I really want my students to know is that I care.
Without a strong culture, nothing else was going to get done.
Teach Me Teacher is, I just want to call it a revolution. If they're talking, if they turn and talk about, you know, whatever we're discussing or maybe giving their opinion about something, that even though they're talking about the same subject, that's still a diffuse mode for them?
Yes, because for one thing, they are when they're focusing on you, they're focusing. When they're turning to talk in a more relaxed way, well, for even just a few seconds of, you know, they're not having to focus on something. And they're kind of letting internal organic thoughts arise. That is characteristic of the default mode network. So it may be a few moments. It may be longer. Once they begin actually focusing on doing something, well, they're focusing again, but they've gotten a little break, and they're actually focusing from a somewhat different perspective. It also allows them to reflect on, did they understand what you just said? I'm able to, for example, in my engineering probability and statistics class, it is a very intense course with a great deal of information that I am expected to impart. But by imparting the information with very good lectures when I do talk and chalk, but with plenty of breaks where the students can reflect on the material and kind of take a step back, and it's not like they've got to focus on me and watch me. They're actively doing it themselves. That is terrifically helpful. It kind of allows for a bit of that back and forth kind of thinking that is characteristic of good learning.
So one of the things that you said there that I really want to hit on is the... So, okay, we have kids all day, right? You know, 8 hours a day here. I teach at a middle school, so they have 50 minutes per class around there with like a 20 to 30 minute lunch or so. But they don't really have a lot of times for breaks. And I think every teacher knows this, that like your morning kids are like half asleep, and then there's like an afternoon rush of like cognitive awareness because of certain things. And then there's the end of the day, like funk, right? Kids become antsy. You know, it's not that they're out, they're disengaged. It's that they're like, their eyes are on, you know, going home and playing video games or going home or seeing their friends or something like that. So my question to you really about this diffuse mode is, when it comes to looking at a whole day, right, we're asking our kids to learn and sit in seats and follow rules and follow procedures all day. How does this, the focus versus diffuse, work in that long of a time frame? Because is it really like, can the brain effectively go, you know, 15 minutes of focus, you know, 2 minutes of diffuse, 15 minutes of focus for 8 hours a day? Or should we be thinking as educators about allowing certain types of longer diffuse modes or longer focus modes? Like, how do you get what I'm trying to get at?
Yes. That's a very good question, and I don't think we have the answer yet. Part of it is, research on the development of expertise has shown that most people can concentrate, that they can put in real concentration for a maximum of about 4 hours. And so... So what that really means is that sometimes they're just not able to concentrate. I mean, if if we're really expecting 8 hours of full concentration, that's just not going to happen. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that we're not really expecting 8 hours of full concentration. There's getting up, moving between classes, doing these kind of, there are some other activities. I think we're doing the best we can with what we've got. The only thing I could say is exercise is incredibly important. When I was going through school, there were still mandatory physical education sorts of classes. If at least one of those periods is a mandatory physical education, that is research is showing how valuable. If we could see, exercise helps produce a brain-derived neurotrophic factor that is like fertilizer for memory and learning. It's a very valuable substance. And in fact, we can see if you sprinkle BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, on a neuron, you will see on the dendrites how little dendritic spines will just begin popping right out. There's some terrific research that's shown that. That's what makes the physical connections that are the architecture of learning. So you can think of it this way. When a student is focusing on you in class, their little dendritic spine, you know, this one little spine, it kind of emerges like a little toe on the dendrite. And then when the student goes to sleep at night, though, especially if they review the material just before they go to sleep, that dendritic spine just pops out. And over the night, your dreams actually kind of run back over that dendritic spine, that little connection, and strengthen it. So this is why when for good learning, sleep is very, very important. If you don't go to sleep, it's like the architecture grows, for the most part, when you're sleeping. So if you give yourself sort of a short shrift on sleeping, you're actually kind of cutting off the ability of that neural architecture to properly form. Also, if you're cramming at night or cramming at the last minute before a test, you can only grow so many synaptic connections in one evening. So that means if you cram, you kind of got these really weak connections that just die right away. But if you study repeatedly over a number of days, just 1 hour a day, as opposed to 10 hours of cramming, you'll have a much more solid architecture of learning. And if you exercise during those days as well, get some little, you know, some exercise in there, it sprinkles BDNF on, and so it allows even more solid connections to be made. And this is why, for example, athletes, they used to wonder, well, why is it that athletes seem to do better when they're competing in their classes? They get better grades. And they're like, are they just more efficient? They're planning their schedules. Well, it's a correlation, but it looks like that it may simply be the exercise, the enhanced exercise that athletes have during those competitive seasons that allows them to learn more effectively. That is what is, producing these better grades.
When we're talking, I couldn't help but think about, like, my favorite, I mention them all the time on the podcast, but the Ron Clark Academy, Ron Clark, he's famous for using a lot of methods. But what's funny is when I was watching him teach and talk about everything that they're doing, a lot of it is brain-based. They don't present it like that, but they get their kids moving a lot. They get their kids mm-hmm. to dance. They get their kids to use callback. So if I say, if I yell shark bait, they go, ooh-ah-ha, right? And then they're in it. And there's all kinds of really cool stuff like that. And what happens is, and what Ron, they have kids with drums on there. So if there's they'll have transition time. And then there's one kid who he'll have the drum and he's playing. And then everyone else is kind of doing their transitions and they get to their spot. And when a teacher asked Ron why how did the drum thing start? you know, is it just a love for music? And he goes, no. He goes, like, I took the most antsy kid and I gave him something to hit when we're doing something that he could move around with. But really, he was just being a great person watcher. And he realized that movement and activity benefited. He might have, at the time, he might have not have realized that there was this psychological connection. I imagine moving and just even a little bit of exercise is beneficial to the learning process, right? It doesn't have to be you go out and run a mile. It can be you get up and kind of just get your heart rate up. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. So he is very smart to be doing that, some movement. And I think a challenge for us today is particularly little boys are, I mean, they're geared from an evolutionary basis to be active, to be moving. Little boys who just kind of sat around and weren't actively aware of what was going on in their environment would probably, you know, not survive as well. And certainly, we think of, for example, attention deficit disorder as some kind of a problem, but actually it can be a real advantage in many circumstances, and it certainly is an evolutionary advantage in that if you're really focused on something that's right in front of you, well, you're not going to be aware of all these other things that could arise and kill you. And so having that sort of attention that jumps from place to place, and even you are actively, you know, jumping from place to place and more aware of what's going on around you. So it can be an advantage from an evolutionary perspective. It's just not perceived as such by teachers in the classroom who, you know, obviously want to have their child focusing on what they're doing. So, I think that the more we can make our teaching sort of broadly encompassing so that it also is helpful for even for kids who have this need to be moving around, that is a great approach.
You know, it's the more we talk, the more I'm just picturing in my head, like, you know, it's almost our job as teachers, you know, we have so much to do, and a lot of people see moving structures and stuff like that and getting kids up, you know, it's almost like they're like, you know, I just don't have time. There's so many things I have to cover. But in my mind, it's almost like we don't have time not to meet the learning needs of children. Like, we need to understand what an adolescent's mind looks like, what it needs, what it craves in order to learn more. And I think diving into, like, the psychology of it and really understanding, you know, why does the brain do this? Why, you know, like you said, you know, from an evolutionary standpoint, a boy, you know, it's literally in his DNA to kind of need that movement, to be looking around and stuff like that. And to avoid that because of whatever reason, I think we're doing a big disservice to our student population, you know. What learning looks like for adults is not what it looks like for 11-year-olds and 12-year-olds and 6-year-olds and stuff like that. They need, they just need variety in terms of how we're approaching them. And I think the diffuse idea and everything we just talked about is super powerful. But one of the things I wanted to ask you, and it's okay if this is kind of out of left field, but one of the things that teachers increasingly deal with is student anxiety. And we deal with students who, they come from all kinds of backgrounds. You know, we have, like, specifically in my school over here in Texas, you know, we had a big wall of like little banners that showed the 30 different countries our students came from. And a lot of them came from war-torn countries, and they've seen things that, you know, Americans only see in movies predominantly, or we see on the news, but we don't know what it's like to live in those situations. So they come here with a lot of stress, a lot of anxiety, a lot of these other things. Kids that live here have home lives that do this. And I wanted to know, how does that affect attention for our students from a scientific look, just so we can understand, like, should we, when it comes to asking these kids to focus, are there things that we can do to help them in that focus area? Because I think the issue with teachers is we're working with these students, and sometimes it's like, you know, they can't focus. And kids that chronically struggle in school, it always seems like there is that anxiety or stress level that is working in the background. Are there tools or ideas that we could use to kind of help us reach, get them into the focus and diffuse modes and away from the anxiety and stress levels of the brain?
Well, that's a very good question. And I hark back to many of my, for example, my electrical engineering instructors came from, for example, one of my instructors was from Poland. He grew up, you know, watching the Nazis, you know, hiding from the Nazis, playing with hand grenades, which were later discovered to be live hand grenades. And by many modern psychological, you know, or psychologists, he should just be completely a wreck as a human being. And of course, he's not. And I think part of what helped him was simply having good, stable teachers and information to learn. Just being a teacher and teaching something allows a student to begin to learn to focus. And when you're focusing on one thing and learning it, there's abundant evidence that learning itself is like a therapy. It really is helpful. And I think one of the things you have to be most careful of is treating a student who's from a very, you know, difficult background like this differently and kind of setting the expectation in their mind that they're going to have it much more difficult because of the background that they've come from, then they will live up to your expectations. We know that many, you know, that students are able to go through unbelievable traumatic experiences and come out successfully. And I think simply being a really good teacher who provides a stable, happy learning environment, you know, coaching on the side if needed, is one of the best therapies you can possibly provide for students who have gone through these really, really difficult experiences. I hear in the massive open online course from individuals who suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. And surprisingly, one of the therapies they found that helps them the most is that of the Pomodoro technique, where you remove all distractions, so nothing going on in your cell phone or nothing popping up on your computer. Set a timer for 25 minutes. Focus as intently as you can for 25 minutes on whatever you're learning, you know, moving away distractions as they inevitably will arise in your monkey mind, and then reward yourself at the end of this 25 minutes. And this is almost like a working meditation. And if kids are taught this kind of thing, when their mind wants to wander off to, you know, these very disturbing thoughts, which actually are affiliated with the default mode network, the diffuse mode, if they learn to gently bring their thoughts back to whatever they're focusing on, it can actually help them to feel better about themselves. And of course, they're going to get be more effective in whatever they're learning. So it's helpful from that perspective as well.
I find it endlessly fascinating that, you know, the best advice I've been given, not by psychologists, by teachers, is the stuff that you're echoing that connects to the science behind stuff. You know, I've already brought up Kagan and Ron Clark, but this, I've been told over and over again that the best thing you can do for students is to be constant, to be that rock in the classroom that, you know, they know procedures and they know what's coming. And it's their, you know, if no matter what else happens, they know when they come to Chastain's class that it's going to be this way. And they go to Dennis's class and it's going to be that way. And they go to Warren's class and they go to all these places. And those, you know, I can echo, like, you know, I've had students who that really do, like, you know, they cling to these classrooms, right? Like the students who like will come in and they'll like not want to do the work more than anyone. They're the ones who don't leave, right? They're the ones who stay after school and they want to be in the classroom. And it's because of that constant, just normal life that they can expect in that room. And I think that's just so invaluable. Like, if we imagine, you know, if a kid has 8 periods, you know, 8 classes where they knew exactly what was going to happen, relatively, right? I mean, things change, but they had that place. I mean, there could just be so much benefit to students if they had that much stability for 8 hours a day, right?
That is so true. And I think it's just, it's important for teachers to realize that simply doing a good job at what they do is invaluable therapy for kids who are coming from difficult circumstances. And in that sense, they're heroes.
I'm a teacher affirmer. That's what I call. I used to call this like a mobile PD that people could listen to and learn from. But more and more I do the podcast. You know, I've been doing it for 2 years, 68 or 70 episodes at this point, which will be more by the time this releases. But it's, you know, where like teacher affirming, like teachers need to realize, like, they're awesome. Like, you know, like teachers saved my life. You know, I came from a background of, you know, family was addicted to drugs, abuse on all kinds of levels and stuff like that. And the one thing that kept me going was teachers, always.
Yep.
And that's what made me become a teacher. And that's why I do things like this, is I want to support the community.
Oh, and you yourself are living proof that you can come from a really tough background and kind of turn it around and spread that good cheer to others.
Yeah, and it's infinitely fascinating to me that just having, you know, not every teacher I had was amazing, but I had enough to where there's so many positive experiences with education. And it just, you know, it always saddens me when I see teachers who are kind of jaded by the experience. I'm like, you're so important. Like, don't get jaded. Like, there's districts are crazy and admin can be bonkers and like life can be super stressful along with having 30 kids every hour in your space. But you're so important. Like, don't stop doing what you're doing.
Exactly right.
Now, okay. Right. What I want to do is I kind of want to give what would be your kind of closing statements in terms of what are the most practical things that teachers can take away from this episode into their classrooms or into their thinking even, right? It doesn't have to go directly into their classrooms, but it, just advice for them on how to implement these ideas of how we learn and how those can be applicable to our daily lives coming up as school is starting again.
Well, I think just a reminder that procrastination is kids' biggest impediment to good learning. And the more they can structure whatever they're teaching to have sort of frequent, low-stakes feedback from students, the better their students will be. If their students have to wait and cram over a number of weeks, you know, so that they are only checked on their knowledge every few weeks or, you know, a month or something like that, they'll wait until the last minute. But if you have little checkpoints, the more you can see, I'm going to say that testing is really valuable, but when I say testing is valuable, I don't necessarily mean, you know, these high-stakes tests. I mean, teach students to test themselves. Because students just don't know sometimes. They'll look at a page, it's right in front of them, and they think it's in their mind, but it's not, because they haven't created that neural structure. And the only way they know it's in their mind is to test themselves. So the more that teachers can encourage kids to test themselves with, you know, can you solve that problem? Do you understand that concept? Can you explain it to someone else? The better off their students will be.
such a useful episode in terms of, you know, you're one of those people who you just have so much freaking knowledge in your brain that I just want to talk to you forever. It's like my private course. I always tell people, like, my podcast, you know, I do it for the educators who listen, you know, in the 62 countries that we're being played in. And my, yeah, that's a cool milestone that we hit. But, you know, it's also like, it's such a selfish thing for me because I get to talk to you guys and ask whatever I want. So it's like my personal, professional development, like 100% of the time. But before I let you go, Barb, what are some of the things, if people wanted to find you, look up your work, read your articles, do whatever you need to do, where are you? Where would be the best places that you could plug right now for them to get in contact with your work?
Oh, just go to my website, barbaraoakley.com, and if they would like to get a weekly email from me, then just sign up for the Learning How to Learn course. And there's a link right at the towards the top of the page, and it just says Learning How to Learn on Coursera. It is a free course, so no need to sign up for the certificate. You can just take it. And once you register, people will get my free weekly emails all about learning and it just sort of whatever strikes my fancy. And I think that's probably the best way to keep up with what I'm doing and learn what I'm all about.
Ladies and gentlemen, that is it for Teach Me Teacher, at least for today. If you enjoyed this episode or any episode that you've ever heard from the show, do me a favor, go over to iTunes, hit that star button, let us know how we're doing, leave a review if you are a verbose type of person and you love to write. I love seeing these reviews. Someone put in one of the last reviews that I saw, they left a comment of saying a topic that we should hit on. I would love for you guys to do that. You could always send topics my way if you think that there is something that I need to hit on that we have not done so already. Remember, just the same as last episode, I am giving away a copy, three copies of Learning How to Learn. If you would love to receive one of these copies, you can either do TMT takeaways, which I'm looking for, or I'm feeling extra generous today. So if you just want to DM me either on Facebook, Instagram or Twitter, feel free to do so. I will get that book to you. Okay. I'm giving away three by the end of next week. If you want a copy of that, it is amazing to use in your classroom. It's also great information for you. Remember, it's a book written about learning for kids to be able to read, but adults to be able to read alongside them. I think it's a perfect tool for nonfiction in our classrooms. Could be wonderful in all subjects, but definitely in ELA. So if you want one of those, reach out to me either with TMT takeaways or directly to me in my messages, and I will get one of those books to you. For everything else, ladies and gentlemen, have a good one.